This week I'd like to invite you to join me in thinking about community and the culture of community, about the ways that we come together in a world that often tries to keep us apart. In this conversation, I take it that my job is to give us some ideas to play with, and your job is to play with them by asking questions, adding concepts, speaking from your own experience. In the course of the week, I'd like to think about with you and talk about with you some several questions, including these. What are people for? Are they made for community? What is community? What is community for? In Wendell Berry's word, what is the value of community? How has community changed in American history? How is it changing now? Where do we find community in our lives? And where do we make it? How is work a part of our community and vice versa? How is nature part of our community and vice versa? Today, I'd particularly like to talk about the way that we think about ourselves and our relationships. In general, as Robert Bella and his co-authors have shown in Habits of the Heart, we are a culture of ontological individualism. The word ontological, I always have to look up even when I've written it in my own essays. It means that in the nature of the world, that we believe that individualism is in the nature of the world. We believe that individuals are the basic building blocks of the universe and that groups consist of conglomerations of individuals. We believe that friends should be congenial people we share leisure activities with, unlike a classic definition of friends that combined this conviviality with an ability to do good for one another and a common project to the common good. That used to be understood as part of what friendship always was. When we think about groups, we believe in a social contract, first concept on the board there, by which individuals agree to be part of groups and maybe even of communities. From baseball's free agents to insurance agents, we think of ourselves engaged in contractual relationships. The prevailing practical conception of marriage in America is generally not sacrament, but contract. Bella suggests that many Americans live not in communities, but in what he calls lifestyle enclaves, places where we are surrounded by people with the same consumption habits as ourselves, places where we reside but don't inhabit. Many suburbs, for example, are bedroom communities, where people commute from their homes to workplaces all over the metro area, returning to their private homes only for dinner and an evening of TV before bed. And I think the term bedroom communities is kind of instructive because the bedroom is the most private place of the house, and bedroom community then is to say that the house that becomes only the private place. And it creates that dichotomy that we have in American culture between public and private that's very strong. Daniel Boorstin suggests that people who live such isolated lives often understand themselves in terms of what he calls consumption communities. In a consumption community, we are brought together not by what we do together, but by what we buy separately. We are Coke drinkers or Honda drivers or Nike wearers. The best example of a conscious consumption community that I can think of is the Saturn Car Company, which presents images like an annual picnic that make us think that there's more to a Saturn than its transportation capabilities. Beyond the level of residence and consumption, we do feel the bonds and binds of the nation state, but we generally spend more time complaining about taxes, which are our contribution to the common good, than we spend in any sort of national service. During the 60s, the metaphor of the global village seemed appealing, but now I think we are resigned to the more problematic possibilities of the global marketplace. There are many benefits of this American individualism. Personal freedoms, for example, depend on some conception of individualism, so I'm not willing to give it up at all. But there are problems too, and one of the problems is figuring out how a contractual relationship stays together. If a contract lasts only as long as the individuals are completely satisfied, then what kind of security or community or continuity can we have? This topic is a fairly new one for me, one that's come up in my research in my life. I've never taught a class on community, but I'm planning to pay attention to community in classes in the fall. My plan this week, therefore, is to connect some stuff I know well on the 60s with some other stuff I'm in the process of learning. I'm hoping that in some of these areas, many of you will know more than I do, and that you'll be willing to share your knowledge and experience too. I choose the 60s because I know a lot about them, and because I think they pose questions that are particularly useful for people in the 90s. The conventional wisdom on the 60s, the wisdom that Newt Gingrich dispenses and that many of us believe, is that the 60s were the cultural crossroads when America turned the wrong way. Inspired by the radical left and the counterculture, the story goes, the country embraced big government, the welfare mess, the Vietnam syndrome, rock music, free love, psychedelic drugs, undisciplined education, affirmative action, multiculturalism, cultural relativism, secular humanism, feminism, homosexuality, and the devil all at once.
Amen.
The only thing wrong with this conventional wisdom is the facts. Indeed, contrary to this media imagery, I would like to suggest instead that the spirit of the 60s was essentially spiritual. The 1960s can be very useful in thinking about community in America. Each day, therefore, I'd like to begin with some stories from the 60s, some ways of thinking about persons in community, and then I'd like to apply these concepts to our own time. If we think about the 60s not just as a political movement, but as movements of the spirit, we will need to recover the original meaning of the word religion. At its most radical, at its root, because the word radical means getting to the root, the word religion means connectedness. From the Latin verb religare, it means to bind together, and it is meant to bind people to God, people to each other, and people to God's creation. We still have some sense of that religare or ligare in our word ligament, which is the part of the body that ties things together. In the 60s, a good part of what happened is that a large group of privileged young people, for the most part, began to understand their connectedness to the rest of the world and to act as if God had something to do with it. They had learned this sense of connectedness from several different groups of old people, Catholic workers like Dorothy Day, civil rights activists like Martin Luther King, radical pacifists like A.J. Mustey and David Dellinger, poets like Allen Ginsberg and Gary Snyder, who taught young people in the 60s what I would call political personalism. That's a term you've probably never heard before, but it's the central theme of my book. Marzi has a handout, which you can pass around now, that'll give you a sense of what that is. Political personalism was a set of beliefs and behaviors summarized in two related slogans: the personal is political, and the here and now revolution. I'd like to describe that personalism to you today, and then think a little bit about what the implications might be for today's society. And this handout is essentially what I'm going to say right now. So the handout is just because political personalism is such a weird term that I think you need something to read at the same time so that you have a sense of what it's about. Political personalism was an eclectic integration of radical traditions in American history. The personalism of the 1960s was a combination of Catholic social thought, communitarian anarchism, radical pacifism, and humanistic psychology. It was a way of looking at and looking out for the world. Too unorganized to be a philosophy or an ideology, political personalism was more a creed than a catechism, more a perspective than a particular position. Although there were extraordinary variations, personalist politics generally operated on the following assumptions. And here is the Reader's Digest condensed book version of the main structure of the book. First, political personalism stressed the inviolable dignity of persons, and they used this term persons more than the term individuals because it carried more weight for them, which was not the same as the rights of individuals. For some personalists, the dignity of human beings was God-given. For others, it was just a given. But if people were created in God's image, as religious personalists believed, then other people were obligated to treat them well. In many ways, then, the genesis of 60s protest was Genesis. Second, personalism focused especially on poor and marginal persons, using their condition as an index to the health and justice of society. In a personalist perspective, poor people were a sure sign of an impoverished society. An edifice that produces beggars, said Martin Luther King, needs restructuring. Political personalists fought for equality, for the full inclusion of the despised and dispossessed into society. Third, political personalism was suspicious of big systems, including the market economy and the state, because they were not ultimately focused on the dignity of persons. Personalists were suspicious of the market economy because they did not believe in homo economicus, who feels no obligation to others. That's economic man, which is really the presumption of most economists. And homo economicus is a self-interested individual who feels no obligation to others. They decried the depersonalization of people in the impersonal factories and bureaucracies of the modern economy, and they refused to countenance the injustices that the market accepted as normal. And when you think about it, it's a lot. The market is willing to accept an awful lot of injustice in the name of efficiency. Personalists were suspicious of the state, in part because they feared the corruptions of power, and in part because the habit of looking to the state for solutions to social problems excused individuals who could be doing something here and now. Therefore, they questioned the statist voice of post-war political discourse and spoke instead in what Robert Carl Manoff calls the civil voice. Fourth, personalists believed in the revolution of the heart and the here and now revolution that came from the personal practice of moral beliefs. Political personalists did not think that this revolution was optional. Instead, they saw it as an essential obligation, and obligation is a term that gets used over and over again, an essential obligation of vocation and of citizenship. They believed, as the Greeks did, that the purely private life is deprived, and that the word private actually comes from a root that means deprived, because the Greeks thought public life was where human beings were made. That was how you became human, was being public. Rejecting important assumptions of liberal individualism, they thought that people were created for and constituted in community and were morally responsible for each other. Religious personalists understood vocation not just as a job, but as a call to help create the kingdom of God on earth. And they understood citizenship not just as residency in a country, but as an active collaboration for the common good. Fifth, personalists believed that changes in consciousness and changes in consciousness could bring social change. They hoped to convert moribund individuals to moral action. They hoped to make Americans more personable or person-able, not more friendly, but able to perceive and preserve the personhood of their neighbors. Because they believed in the revolution of the heart and the personal practice of moral beliefs, they did not depend on specific groups in society, the proletariat, for example, in their theory of social change. That had been something in the old left. Had really depended an awful lot on the proletariat or the labor union movement for social change. But political personalism said social change can happen in a lot of different places because individuals are created in community, constituted for community, and are moral agents wherever they are, whatever their power is. Sixth, although they expected individuals to act responsibly, which is to say in response to God's call on their own, personalists did not stop, as many American reform movements have, with an emphasis on the conversion of the individual. They understood the importance of institutions, and they acted politically for social and structural changes. Assuming that the institutions of a community created and converted individuals, they took political action to affect law and policy and to create structures of justice, which they saw as love in action. As Bayard Rustin said after serving a prison term for draft refusal, "I came out of prison realizing that talking to individuals about being good is a pile of crap. You have to have social organization which helps people bring out the goodness in them, not one that brutalizes them." Seventh, political personalists believed that people in community could govern themselves and their needs to reduce the conflicts caused by competitive individualism, laissez-faire capitalism, and corporate liberalism. As believers in literal self-government, and usually when Americans hear the term self-government, they think that it has something to do with the Declaration of Independence and that it refers to a political body. What the personalists meant was self-government, the self. Everybody governs themselves. If everybody were virtuous, restraining their own actions, you wouldn't need so much government to kind of keep us out of each other's faces. So as believers in literal self-government, they were often communitarian anarchists, advocating not disorder, which is what we normally associate with the term anarchism, but less coercive and competitive forms of order. Preferring the voluntarism of free people to the coercions of the state, they wanted to strengthen local institutions more than the national government. They believed that conscientious individuals could create a new world in the shell of the old, a world in which it would be easier to be good. And that is one of my favorite phrases. It comes from Peter Morin in The Catholic Worker, and something that was picked up on in the 1960s. But what they wanted was institutions that would make it easier for people to be good. And when you think about the institutions that we now have, many of our institutions are structured in ways to make it easier for us to be not necessarily bad, but not to be good, but to be, I don't know, not one particular thing or another, but in the long run, structurally bad for each other, I think. Throughout the 1960s, therefore, personalists created parallel institutions to serve whole persons better than the established institutions could. The prefigurative politics of this here and now revolution was a hallmark of political personalism. Eighth, assuming the essential harmony of personal and political life, political personalists assumed that everyday values, especially religious and household values like compassion and cooperation, should and could be applied to politics. Rejecting the Christian realism, say of somebody like Reinhold Niebuhr, that created separate spheres of ethics for individuals and corporate entities, they embraced the values which women had nurtured in the separate spheres of the American cult of domesticity. In many ways, the political personalism of the post-war era was a lot like domestic feminism of the turn of the century in its attempts to apply women's values to the public sphere. And this in spite of the fact that the 60s culture was a strongly macho culture. It was sort of a macho culture working for feminist values, which is a really weird thing, but it was true. Political personalists believed in the harmony of rhetoric and reality. They believed that language was communal and the purpose of words is to tell the truth. Hypocrisy in the 60s was one of the cardinal sins, and political personalists regularly called the American authorities to account for their rhetoric. The credibility gap, which developed during the decade, was to political personalists a violation of the linguistic social contract that bound people to each other, and a violation of democratic theory, which assumes that citizens need to be informed to act wisely. So if the government was lying to you, democratic theory was being violated. Tenth and last, I've managed to make this in 10 because the Reader's Digest always has 10 reasons for everything. 10 reasons why your marriage is failing, 10 reasons, you know, why you're having heartburn. 10, political personalists also believed in the harmony of means and ends. The more violence, they said, the less revolution. They believed that the beloved community would be the product of a process of love. Consequently, in their organizations and actions, they tried to practice the cooperative virtues that they hoped would characterize a future society. We're at a point now where in a modular talk, we could stop for a minute and see if you have any responses or actions or I could go on.
Yeah. I was very interested and read carefully and listened carefully to your comments in the beginning. Every word here, there's one word I never saw. The word is responsibility.
Yeah, it actually comes in the word obligation, I think. But I think responsibility is really at the core of it. And it is in there at one point where I talked about the responsibility being a response to God's call. I think vocation and citizenship were both ways in which they saw the responsibility of people in the 60s.
Okay, there's another definition of responsibility, namely the individual being responsible for his or her actions, and that along with the demand, and maybe rightly so, of rights, come the obligations of responsibility.
Yeah, actually, I'm going to argue that that's the main thing of the 60s, is exactly what you said. I think that the 60s is usually misrepresented as a do-your-own-thing time, which I would say is the antithesis of responsibility. And certainly the phrase do your own thing was around in the 60s, particularly in the counterculture. But what was interesting, even when people were saying do your own thing, they were usually saying it in the context of a community like a commune or an alternative community. So there was always a kind of social responsibility involved in do your own thing. What I found in my research is that there's a lot less individualism in the 60s than people expect, and a lot more responsibility. And I would say, and this would be the second part of what I would talk about today, that Martin Luther King is the preeminent figure of the 1960s, that almost everybody respected and believed in the ways that Martin Luther King approached things. And that King called people just over and over again to responsibility. It was the essential message of the 1960s, was to be responsible for each other. And yet, being responsible for each other makes bad TV. Good TV is when you get a bunch of people hanging around, burning flags, yelling, do your own thing, and stuff like that. I think we have essentially a TV image of the 1960s that doesn't reflect what was going on in many places in the 1960s. Many of the national demonstrations did develop into disorderly demonstrations that made good TV. At the local level, the 60s were almost entirely personalist.
And you may have just answered it in one sense. My question is, are you going to be covering what went wrong that out of the 60s then, given the personalist view, rather than making almost wholesale corrections in our lifestyle, or whatever you want to call what they were after, resulted in what has become now a severe drug problem with young people, severe promiscuity, and all of that seemed to also come out of the 60s. And will you cover what went wrong that sent some people that direction and others into community responsibility?
Yeah, we'll talk about that. And actually, I'll give you a short answer now, maybe a long answer later. My sense is, in the first place, that political personalism doesn't stop. Usually people think that sometime around 1970 or 1972 or something like that, the 60s ended. But if you pay real close attention to the 70s, and the first book on the 70s, the title is It Seemed Like Nothing Happened. Because we usually think of the 60s being a really lively decade, and the 70s being a dull time when nothing happened. In fact, though, there were lots of things that happened in the 1970s that were a continuation of political personalism. Feminism, for example, is a continuation of political personalism, and almost all feminism is 1970s feminism. Now, for example, is not established until 1966. Most of the very first interesting feminist books are written in 1970. So it's really something from the 70s. The environmental movement, which is I will talk about Wednesday and Friday of this week, or not Wednesday, Friday, Thursday and Saturday of this week, also comes out of it. And in the 1970s, the environmental movement is largely a local movement. It's part of what I would call the backyard revolution. So there are lots of those things going on. My sense is that while the 60s in some ways contributed to drug problems and the kind of promiscuity that you're talking about. In many ways, those things were more a part of a larger culture that had been going on since the 1920s. In fact, the people in the 60s didn't have enough power to change the culture in the ways that people like Newt Gingrich think they did. I mean, these were college students college students don't have a lot of power in American society. The really powerful people in American culture are people like advertisers, and advertisers love to advertise for people to be irresponsible. So I would say that it's the mainstream culture more than the counterculture that's responsible for many of the things that we look at as faults of the 1960s.
Stimulated the opportunity
right.
for the others to take advantage.
And what you find in the early 1970s is that manufacturers realize there's a lot of money to be made in anti-materialism, so they begin to sell the kind of beads and the what I would call the superficial aspects of the 1960s back to the 1960s, and to market a 60s kind of thing. So you can see, for example, Dodge in the late 1960s has a slogan that Dodge is the revolution. You know, well, there's no way in which a Dodge car in the late 1960s is really a revolution, but they pick up on the rhetoric of it, and they use that rhetoric to create the kind of individualism that we now associate with the 1960s.
I was interested there. The first thing you said were advertisers, and okay, but what about the media, the other guys? And I happen to have been in the newspaper business, and I know that the media people like to say they're not influenced by the advertisers. And be that as it may, I think the two go hand in hand.
Right.
And so just to say, and I agree with you, these developments in advertising, I would say, well, don't forget the newscasters, the people that choose what goes in, the people that run the Globe and all those Safeway store places.
Right, no, I would agree with that. I mean, the advertiser would sort of be the most visible aspect of what I would call or what Robert Bellah might call the problem of invisible complexity, the complex ways in which the market structures our lives more than we think.
You know, first chicken or the egg, the concept and the advertiser picks up on it, or the advertiser says, I'm going to do it this way, and then the society follows.
Right. Actually, in terms of my answer to the question, which comes first, the chicken or the egg, is always yes.
Okay.
Let me see where we are on time here. I'm going to skip one section here that is really mostly on Martin Luther King, and if you're interested in that, you can look at the book, and it's a section on what I would call civil rights personalism. But I do think King is the main figure of the 1960s, and one of the things that people generally don't know about him is that he had a PhD in philosophy from Boston University. And the reason that he went to Boston University is that it was the center of philosophical personalism in the United States. He had 8 or 9 courses and wrote a dissertation on what was is literally called personalism. There is a philosophy of personalism. Boston University was, for all of the 20th century, the main place for personalism in the United States. And he had studied that very strongly. It doesn't come through a whole lot in his rhetoric because he's trying to talk to a broad population. He doesn't try to talk like a philosopher most of the time in the 1960s. But I would say that King is kind of doing applied philosophy in the 1960s, and he's applying the...
Boston's a Catholic school. Did this come out of the Catholic tradition?
No, this is Boston College is a Catholic school. Boston University is mostly Methodist.
Okay.
Or at least out of a Methodist tradition. But King merged. King, one really good author on King says that King is a what he calls a in the tradition of African American voice merging, which is when African Americans give sermons, they like to merge lots of different voices that are around in the culture as a whole. And King is particularly good at merging the tradition of the African American churches, which I would say is a kind of liberation theology, with the social gospel, which he studied both in divinity school and in his PhD program, with this personalism as well. And he brings the three of them together so integrally that it's real hard sometimes even to take them apart. But two of the themes that are really important in King's work in the 1960s that I think carry over to now are, one is what he called somebodyness, which I would say is the same thing that personalists were talking about when they were talking about the importance of the person. The reason that he was irritated about all of the civil rights problems of the prior to the 1960s was that they were all designed to keep African American people from feeling like they were somebody. And what King is trying to do is to make them feel like somebody. Everybody ought to feel like somebody, essentially, is what one of the messages of the 1960s is, and one that's embodied in King's work. And then other people pick up on that. I mean, it starts really first in civil rights. But then, for example, the students in SDS say, well, it's also true of poor people in this country, that they're generally made to feel like they're not somebody. And so they took the example of the Catholic worker houses and started a program called the Economic Research and Action Project, where they went into inner cities and lived there and tried to help poor people organize their own lives in a, what I would call a communitarian anarchist sort of way, to let them feel like somebody in their own places. And then, in a third wave, women said, actually, when we're thinking about somebody, there are ways in which we don't feel like somebody either, and there are things that we can do about that as well. So I think the 60s is a lot about this theme of what King would call somebodyness, which I think is a wonderful way of describing it. And the other thing that King, I think, is really important for in the 1960s is the idea and the term that he gave to all of the 1960s, the beloved community. If we're thinking about community, he embodies that idea that there can be a beloved community, that love will be the essence of the beloved community. And you find this rhetoric repeated over and over again in places that you don't expect it. For example, in 1964 and 1965, if you look at the speeches that people at SDS gave, in the national conventions and things like that. This is one of the major themes of Students for a Democratic Society, particularly in the early years. You hardly ever see anything on TV or in any kind of history that is popularly available about the early years of SDS, which is following very much this kind of King's idea of personalism. What you tend to see is the later angry SDS after they feel betrayed. So those two things are real important in King, and also King brings us really a new concept of religion. I think that the way that people at Holden largely think about religion comes a lot out of that tradition of the African American churches that Martin Luther King brought into the mainstream. Okay, what I'd like to do now is talk a little bit about the ways in which 60s personalism has something to do with today. And I would suggest that 60s personalism is a precursor to what is now called communitarianism, a political philosophy and a movement with deep roots in American history, rekindled in the 90s as a counterpoint to the selfishness and loss of civic spirit in the me decade of the 1980s. There is no one communitarianism. There are like varieties of communitarianism. But there are some principles that seem to recur in the writings of communitarians, and I'd like to discuss a few of them today. The first is exactly what you were talking about, a balance of rights and responsibility. Communitarians often suggest that a legal system based on rights talk ignores the responsibilities that individuals with rights have to the community. Although the localism of communitarianism keeps them from the statism of John Kennedy's ask not what you, your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country, there is a similar emphasis on service for the community, as service is the way that communitarians see responsibility being acted out. Indeed, service is one of the key methods by which individuals with rights acknowledge their obligations to community. And the National Service Corps, for example, AmeriCorps, is I think, a thoroughly communitarian idea with roots in the 1960s.
But I'm going to have to interrupt to say, okay, let's talk about the Vietnam War and service, and the people out of this tradition were not necessarily into the war situation.
No, the people out of this tradition were largely anti-war, and essentially what they did, and actually let me go back to that John Kennedy quote for that. Kennedy's inaugural, he says, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And lots of people respond to that, because in a way there's a kind of communitarian emphasis there. We will all be working together. And I think there was an excitement about the Kennedy years that people felt very strongly, and particularly people like me, who were Irish Catholics, responded terrifically to the Kennedy years. But when you think about it in retrospect, that phrase, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country, is what people later in the 60s would call statist. It presumes that the state is the most important thing and that people ought to be in the service of the state. What people in the 60s do is to come out of the tradition of Dorothy Day and a kind of radical pacifism that says, in response to the just war theory says essentially that if the government says the war is just, everybody has to serve. Dorothy Day says individuals still have a responsibility to make up their own mind about that. So they exercise their responsibility by deciding that the war is not one that they can conscientiously support, and they opt out of that national service. Most people in the 60s would have been willing, I think, to be involved in some kind of alternate national service, say, in the cities or something like that. But the government didn't want to provide that because they were worried that if they did that, too many people would opt out of the military, and they wouldn't be able to fight the wars that they thought they needed to fight. For a book on service, if you're interested in looking at one, Robert Cole's book, The Call of Service, is just an astoundingly wonderful book on service. The second principle of communitarians involves a balance of the individual and community. Communitarians worry about what Robert Bella calls radical individualism, or what others call ontological individualism, the sense that the self is the center of a Copernican universe, the sense that, as the bumper sticker says, after me, you come first. Yes. For years, polls have shown that individuals in America expect their lives to be better in the future, but they expect both the country and the world to be worse. How this can happen is one of life's mysteries. It can, in fact, happen, but it can only happen if we're willing to permit tremendous amounts of injustice. To counter this individualism, communitarians look for the society's centripetal forces, the things that hold us together. Both African-American personalists like King and other 60s personalists emphasized we more than me, communal pleasures and responsibilities over individual rights. In Marge Piercy's novel, Woman on the Edge of Time, which shows an ecofeminist and personalist utopia, a contemporary American from 1976 who gets to travel into this future utopia tells a person from the utopian future, I ask you about I and you answer about we. Because this utopia that Marge Piercy has created is so much a communitarian utopia that people have a hard time thinking about what I could possibly mean. Exactly the opposite of American society, where we're absolutely comfortable with what one person calls the perpendicular pronoun, I, but have a hard time with we. Okay, third, both of these balances between rights and responsibilities and between the individual and community come from a foundational sense of the related self. That's one of the terms that's on the board. Communitarians don't believe in the self-made man or woman because they see no evidence at all for the phenomenon. Beings like us become human beings in community, where other people care for us. We learn to communicate in community because both language and gestures are communal sign systems. Insofar as our words are our worlds, and for human beings that's a lot, we are never entirely individuals. Even when I am alone reading, I am in the company of those who taught me to read and those who wrote what I am reading. Most of the time when I feel what we mistakenly call personal fulfillment, it's not just personal. It's the individual or personalist feeling that comes from having done something good in a group. Indeed, it might even be fair to say that both our persons and our personal feelings are learned in large part in community. And this is something that I would agree with in terms of the communitarianism. Simply, people don't make themselves at all. You make yourself almost always in conversation, and human beings, Homo sapiens as a species, it simply can't survive on its own. It takes a community, it takes somebody else nurturing you for some period of time so that you can become a self. So this idea of the related self seems to me to be a really important idea. And yet it's not the dominant way that we think about self in American society. We tend to think about self as self-made.
I see that concept as existing through childhood, and when you become an adult, then you start to compete. So you take advantage of that nurturing, and then but then you stop doing that, and you look at, did I achieve more than the guy next to me?
Right, that's because we, in American culture, what our community teaches us, actually the way that community socializes us is what I would call socialization for autonomy or independence. We socialize people to be separate. And this starts very, very early, back to when, for example, your child could first tie her shoes. Mm-hmm. You can tie them all by yourself, mm-hmm. we say. That's the way you teach individualism, and we do that all through our children's lives, so that we do teach them to be individualist and competitive.
A little earlier, you were saying self-esteem and somebody-ness.
Yes.
Was good. A little later, we're talking about the self-made person is bad. Now, I don't quite see how that meshes. If self-esteem, a person gains by achieving something. But how can you achieve something if you're not a self-made type person?
Well, I think what he's saying, though, is that there's nothing wrong with achievement or self-esteem, but I think what he's saying is that you really don't do it in isolation, is that there is a whole community there contributing to what we consider today to be self-made success.
Right. I mean, I think she has that right. She's married to me, so of course she would. even if she were wrong, I couldn't say so right here. But essentially, let me give you an example of that. I am right now finishing a term at St. Olaf as the OC and Patricia Bolt Distinguished Teaching Professor in the Humanities. And there are people who could say, you are self-made. You have done all of the things that are required to be a success in teaching in the humanities at a college level, and that's a wonderful thing. The way that I tend to think about it is that I have always been involved in communities of conversation that make it possible for me to accomplish these sorts of things, so that there's no way in which I individually am responsible for that success. And you could go back to my childhood. Both of my parents were college graduates. They read to me a lot. These are all things that get you to be in the situation where you have what I would call the life chances to be a college professor or to be a distinguished college professor. I see very little of the self-made part in there. I've taken advantage of opportunities that others have provided for me, and in conversation with others, I've become a better teacher and that sort of thing. But I see very little narrow self involved in that.
You're saying success is not bad. It's the view of how you became successful that may be the issue.
Right. I mean, if I were to say I did it all myself. I mean, think of how that would distance me from the community that I'm a part of. Think about what a horrible program a distinguished teaching professorship would be if we thought that each distinguished professor did it all by themselves. It would mean that nothing comes from the community. In fact, I have lots of mentors at St. Olaf and elsewhere who have been an integral part of that success. So I think success is a wonderful thing, but we need to ground that success in community and to see what we now see as individual successes as community successes.
Your comments make me remember that we heard in Russia, in the preschool, all of the activities for children was designed. No one child could do any of it alone. It all had to be done as a group in the community.
Right. I'm not sure that I
want. Collapsed, however.
I'm not sure that, I mean, that seems to be, that's, in Russia, during the period of communism, there was a statist emphasis to education. And I don't want to support a kind of statism. It seems to me that I like the phrase communitarian anarchism very much. Anarchism in the sense that it's that individuals govern themselves, but that they always do it in community. There's a nice balance there in that that seems to me to be appropriate. I would like very much for people in American schools to do more stuff in groups. Our son went to an alternate school until he was in sixth grade, and they did lots of group work, and he learned a tremendous amount from sometimes when he knew the stuff really well, explaining it to somebody else. It's a great pedagogical device to have people who know something teach it to somebody else. And other people, you know, a kid learning from another sixth grader is probably feeling better about that than learning about it from the teacher. I would love to see more cooperative activity in education. In fact, I'll talk about that some on Friday when I'm going to talk about learning communities. Because what happened to him is that for various reasons, he couldn't stay in that school. He had to go to another school. And they did everything on an individual basis, everybody in their desk, everybody doing their own work. And for him, the fun went out of education because the social part of education was eliminated. So at least in my own teaching, I'm trying to keep people in conversation with each other and often have situations where I have group work where no one person can possibly accomplish the thing by themselves. And they find that, I think, in talking to each other that they enjoy it more and also learn more. Okay, I'm now at number four, if you're keeping track. I had an advisor in graduate school who used to always have lists of 10 reasons for the Civil War, and he'd start one, and then he'd two, and then about half an hour later, he'd say, and 10. So anyway, I'm at number four, just having finished the related self. From this, communitarians emphasize both virtue and values, and an understanding that social institutions make it easier or not for people to be virtuous. They are interested in rights, particularly when those rights lead people to do the right thing. They are interested in sustaining what Philip Selznick calls a moral environment, a situation in which goodness is as important as, what you see a lot now in ads, being bad. Sometimes this gets described as a politics of meaning, because ethical systems or ethical understandings give meaning to people's lives. Both African-American personalists like King and other 60s personalists assumed that individuals must practice virtues in order to sustain communities. They drew on ancient traditions that assumed first that virtue meant the fulfillment of the obligations of membership in a community that was embedded in a larger cosmic order. That's what virtue was. Secondly, virtue meant that people could restrain their passions and make them amenable to reason. And third, virtue always included politics and participation in the civic life of the community. In the ancient world, people and culture cultivated virtues of courage, fortitude, honesty, restraint, charity, chastity, family, personal rectitude, integrity, and reverence. They didn't always succeed, obviously, in practicing these virtues, but the list set standards for behavior. That a list like this sounds old-fashioned to the modern ear suggests how new-fashioned the modern era is. As Lewis Mumford suggested, the modern economy, and especially advertising, make virtues of the seven deadly sins, pride, envy, anger, sloth, avarice, gluttony, and lust, and vices of our virtues because they get in the way of the grossest national product. Fifth, communitarians generally share an emphasis on practices, the regular application of virtue to the events of everyday life, to the events of our common life. Practices are ways that we ritualize our connectedness in the world. They are ways that the habits of our heart get pumped out to the rest of our body and to the body politic. In practicing our faith, Dorothy Bass, who left Saturday and is no stranger to Holden, suggests that practices address fundamental human needs and conditions through concrete human acts. They are practical, but we do them not just because they're practical, but because they're good. Practices, she continues, are done together and over time. They remind us, sort of, they bring to mind over and over again our commitments to each other. And finally, she says, practices embody standards of excellence. They aren't just action, but exemplary action, enacted, we hope, because somebody has thought carefully about the health and goodness of creation. What are some of these practices? Going to church on Sunday, or any day for that matter, is a practice. Regular family meals is a practice. Grace before meals is a practice. The ritual celebration kinds of things are practices. In Rooted in the Land, the book that I've circulated here, Scott Russell Sanders has a beautiful essay on the common life that describes bread baking as a practice that contributes to the common life, because he always bakes with his family. In any case, acts like these are, as Robert Bella might say, practices of commitment. And this is a term I like to think about a lot. Sort of, what are the practices that we have that regularly ritualize our commitment to a community? And Bella would say that practices of commitment then bind us in a community that is both a community of memory with a story that it shares over time. Like, for example, Nancy shared with us the story of the early Holden Village last night. That would be a community of memory. And then also a community of hope, because the trajectory of a past story, of the memory story, always leads into a hopeful direction. Or it's what another friend of mine calls prophetic memory, that you remember things, for example, like the 60s, to use them to confront the 90s with some of the things that it needs to hear.
Well, I have a problem with that. I'm interested that you would emphasize practices, because in terms of melding a community, and I have to switch to California now, and the new people coming in, there's not much point in overemphasizing the memory of the past, because lo and behold, we are associating with people who have different memories, different pasts. And so and we have some people who remember the practice, the culture. We have some people who worship the culture instead of the Christianity. Some people who like the Spanish way of doing things, the Norwegian way of doing things, and the practice, they're so wrought up and so in the habit of that it's almost self-defeating, and we don't think of the larger community.
Right. I mean, I would look for multiple and overlapping kinds of community. It would seem to me that often now you get a kind of a critique of ethnic communities saying that it just divides us, that we sort of reverse the national motto, we pluribus unum, so that it becomes unum pluribus.
We organize ourselves if we're not careful.
But it seems to me that there are lots of ways in which we can be members of overlapping communities. I can be Catholic and a member of the St. Olaf College community. I can be a member of the St. Olaf College community and a member of the city in which I reside. All of those are overlapping ones. Each of them will have their stories. Each of them, hopefully, will have their practices. At some level, those practices will come together. The St. Olaf College community consists of college professors from all over the place. And yet, we need to hear the story of the St. Olaf College story over time to know what it is that we're doing there and the way that we can bring the particular strengths that we have from our own background into that particular community.
Well, okay, but then the question is that how much the individual, relates to that early background as compared with looking forward and embracing the new.
Yeah, I agree. It seems to me that it needs to be a balanced kind of thing. It seems to me that often we don't think now to tell the stories, even family stories. I think kids like to hear family stories of what grandmas and grandpas did over time, and sort of what their trajectory of a family has been over time, because those things locate them in ways that are important to them. To use the term that's the title of the book there, rooted in the land, rooted in the community. You can't be rooted in the community if you don't know the stories.
And that's probably the secret of the merging cultures, is that you have to be willing and interested in hearing the stories of these other communities that you know nothing about.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, indeed, that divides. And if you begin to put values on those stories, this story is a good story and this one is a bad story just because it's different.
Right. We tend in American culture to think a lot in terms of hierarchies. And so when we hear several stories, we usually want to rank them. And I think that's a tendency that we, if we want to have more community, we'll need to overcome. We will need to be more receptive to more different stories. But to go back to what I was talking about with Martin Luther King, one of the really great things about King was that he could tell several stories at once. He could call African Americans to remember their particular story. And the biblical story that he used all the time with African Americans was Exodus. Well, white Americans also knew the story of Exodus, so it was a story that brought the two of them together, although it had really different meanings in the black and white community. And essentially what he did was teach the white community the meanings that it had in the black community. And because he told it in a particular way, white Americans were willing to listen to that. King also told the story of the American story. He kept going back to Thomas Jefferson all the time. All men are created equal. What could that possibly mean? Well, it might mean that everybody's created equal, and then we ought to act that way. And so he kept using that over and over again, and recalling, making us a part of a community of memory. These are the traditions out of the American past that we want to honor. These are the, and that's why King that's why we have a national holiday for King, because he set his agenda within the agenda of the national community, taking the very best part of that national agenda that we have and trying to make it real. Trying to take the language of the Declaration of Independence and say, can we make this a part of our everyday practices, of our everyday lives? Okay, I've got two more things that I want to say about communitarians. One is that they emphasize what I would call a kind of connected localism, scaling down some of the big government emphasis of contemporary liberalism. At its best, this leads to a resurgence of local involvements that make us better participants at the state and national levels. It is the embodiment of the slogan, think globally, act locally. It is participatory democracy, that phrase of the 1960s, at the scale where widespread participation is possible. Sometimes this localism gets disconnected and communitarianism sounds like it's only about a particular place. This seems to me to be real problematic because it can be a kind of middle class communitarianism that's not paying attention to the larger community that we're a part of and the responsibilities that we have around the world. But I do think that at its best, communitarianism can offer us a connected localism where, say for example, what Holden is doing here, this is a local congregation. We're in a particular locality now, and yet the offering last night is connected. It's a connected localism that Holden has. And Holden's sense is that we come together here in a local place to do a particular set of stuff for however long that we're here, and then we're to take it back somewhere else. That's the connection, I think. And so Holden, in many ways, is an example of communitarianism at its finest. Okay, last, given their emphasis on the local action of virtuous individuals here and now, communitarians tend to focus on the civic sphere more than the private sphere or the political arena. Working from de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, they look to family in the broadest sense of the word family, to religion, to voluntary associations, and to local political participation more than to the individual or to the state and federal government. In part, I think this is healthy. These associations affect the health in the broadest sense of our everyday lives more than most legislation does. In the other part, though, it needs to be said that the global marketplace shapes civic institutions more than mere local action affects it back. And so we need to think about the ways in which the localism also needs to pay attention to structural problems that are created by what I would call a global marketplace. Let's conclude by looking at the last handout that I have for you here, which is called, I think, What's Your CQ? What's Your Communitarian Quotient? And The Nation magazine, which is not very fond of communitarianism, did a set of questions to test your community quotient, and I changed them at the bottom of this thing to think about some questions that would tell us something about our involvement in communities that communitarians might approve of. If you have children, do they or did they attend public or private school? Whether or not you have children in the schools, do you belong to the PTA or any other educational organization? Do you do volunteer work in your community? Do you attend a church? Do you participate in any programs beside worship? How many of your neighbors do you know by name? How do you demonstrate your neighborliness? When was the last time outside your home that you participated in a conversation about local politics? When did you participate in a boycott of a product that you consider destructive of some persons or of a community? Do you watch TV? How much? When was the last time that something you saw on TV caused you to act in your community? Do you participate in local call-in radio shows or write letters to the editor? When was the last time you contacted one of your political representatives? Do you have a group of friends that you play with regularly? When was the last time that you participated in a serious conversation that included people who are not just like you, people of your own race and class and status? What groups are you an active member of? How many of these groups are service groups? Those are the kinds of questions that we would ask ourselves to see, in fact, what are our communitarian or our personalist involvements? I was reading something else this morning, and I would add now a 13th question there, which would be, when was the last time you went to a potluck? Because in many ways, a potluck is a practice of community that we, you know, we may think about it as just a way of getting a lot of different kinds of foods and hot dishes and things like that, some of which we don't like. But in another way, it's a really important practice to say, we have things to share, and we're willing to share them with a group.
Question 14, how many hours a day do you put in on your computer?
Yes.
That's going to totally change community over time, and it is right now.
Yeah, apparently there was a forum here last week on computers and community. And I don't know what they resolved.
It's demolished community at the moment, just like TV has demolished a lot of the values of our community by bringing violence and sex and drugs and such into our living rooms. And that we got into that without thinking. We may be into demolishing community without thinking with the technologies that are out there.
Well, I think you're right. We do a lot of these things without thinking because we tend not to think very much about the future or the long-term future. What Americans, when they think about the future, think about tomorrow and maybe next year. In 1979, Jimmy Carter commissioned something called Global 2000, which was to look 21 years ahead, which just seemed like an astounding amount of time for Americans. And people criticized him for that. They just thought that was ridiculous to be thinking that far ahead. But American politics really requires people to think in terms of 4 years at most, or 6 years for senators, which is not long enough, really, because too many things that we do in the short term have consequences in the long term that are unhealthy.
Well, all the computers are going to crash in 2000 anyway, so. No,
they're not. We're going to be out there on something else that's not even going to be near the crash, which is really going to be very interesting. What's going to, you know, in some ways it'll be, talk about the global community. We will have it, and our neighbors next door are not as close as somebody on the other side of the world.
We'll have the global something. I'm not sure global community will be the right word for it. And I use a computer and use it quite a bit. And it seems to me that there are opportunities in computers as well, although I would say that right now most of what goes on computers and on email and things like that is not worth the time devoted to it. It's, you know, junk mail comes in electronic form now instead of in other forms.
It just comes faster.
It comes, yeah, very fast.
But this is the kind of a world we're heading into. What responsibility will the church have to tell us, okay, we cannot have the tides stop. The tide is rolling in. What will the church tell us how to live in that type of community?
Well, I hope the church will be thinking about what kinds of community we ought to live in and what kinds of community are good for us. And in some cases, that the church will resist some things that are coming. I know about 10 years ago at St. Olaf, we were rewriting just the beginning part of our mission statement. And one part of it that got written into an early draft of it was that we would help students adjust to the 21st century. And that just made me furious. I thought, well, it sort of depends on what the 21st century is, whether or not I want them adjusted to it or not. In many ways, the 21st century gets largely depicted for us by advertisers and computer companies and things like that. They try to imagine a high-tech or what I would call a mega-technical world. In many ways, it seems to me as a personalist that a mega-technical world isn't particularly good for human beings, and therefore I would in many ways think that college education at a church like St. Olaf ought to teach students in part to resist the 21st century, or to resist those parts of the 20th century, or to shape it so that it's a 21st century that we would want to adjust our children to.
To change the structure.
Pardon me?
To change the structure. So that the new ones coming up will be more like what we think it should be.
Right. I mean, we need to have a vision of the community that we want. There's a quotation that I'll use on Friday. Paul Goodman in the 1960s said, think about the kind of world you want to live in. Think about what you need to know in order to create that world. Demand that your teachers teach you that. And in many ways, that's what happened in college education in the 1960s. That's why there was so much of an uproar, is that students thought, you know, whatever this stuff is that I'm learning here, I don't think it's going to help me very much in creating the community that I think we ought to live in. It's really helping me adjust more to the community as it is now, which seems to me to be dysfunctional in some ways.
Can that be done slowly?
As a historian, I think it can only be done slowly. And this is one of the virtues of being a historian. You see, the major changes generally only happen slowly. And so it seems to me that one thing at a time. Every little thing helps in some way, and in ways that we can't possibly know.
I think we should remember, too, what Susan said last night, is that we are the church. And I think it's up to us to be vocal in our church communities and say, where do we want, you know, what do we want the church's response to be?
This is a woman who in our church, at one point, in one of the readings, they were reading something from the Catholic bishops that she disagreed with. And so as soon as the sentence was finished, she yelled out from the back of the church, "No!" So she is in fact trained in voicing her opinion, even toward the hierarchy of her own church.
I guess, you know, in terms of getting back to the computers and looking at that, I don't see anything negative in that. I mean, to me, it's just an evolution of, you know, of our whole culture. And, you know, it's no different than printing the Bible. I mean, we don't look back on that now as a negative thing. I mean, it broadened information and gave it to everyone, put everyone more on an equal playing field. And I think you can look at computers in the same way as this. This is going to become such a universal thing that everybody has access to the same information instead of a hierarchical society that only the top people have access to information.
That's possible, I think. I'm not sure that it's probable.
Well, how do you see it different from printing?
Well, in the first place, I would say that there are some things about printing that weren't so good, because printing individualized things. In an oral culture, people had to get together to hear what the stories were. Printing said you could take it off in your own room,
right,
and read it. So it had the advantages that more people could read it when people could read. It had the disadvantage that it brought us away from each other. Computers, at least the way that they're now constituted, do that. We tend to sit at our own monitor and see what's going on the computer. It does put us in contact with lots of people that we formerly wouldn't have had contact with.